Anyway, several years ago, I was sitting in the local empanada cafe, and I know that I mentioned it that same evening here as I was listening to the music that they sometimes, it's like Muzak that's on their television there. And what was playing was Bob Marley's redemption song, Emancipate Yourself from Mental Slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. And it started rolling through my head. So because of that association, when I go into the empanada shop, which I did again this evening, the words of that song will start rolling through my mind. And at the time, I was very struck by the lyrics again, and what a Dharma feel they have. The emancipate yourself from mental slavery. That's really what it's about. It's about liberation. It's about freedom. None but ourselves can free our mind. And I looked it up, and then I discovered that the lyrics were inspired by Marcus Garvey, who many of you probably know as the father of the black nationalist movement, really the forerunner to Black Lives Matter and all the real awakening of the black community and black pride, etc. But I found the actual quote from Marcus Garvey at the time, and I thought I'd share it with you again and then tell you what the next little chain of associations were that came with that. And this was originally published in Black Man magazine sometime, and it was a talk that he gave in Nova Scotia. He said, "We are going to emancipate ourselves from mental slavery, because whilst others might free the body, none but ourselves can free the mind. Mind is your only sovereign or ruler. The man who is not able to develop and use his mind is bound to be the slave of the other man who uses his mind." So this sovereignty over our mind or our heart, mind to me are the same. It's only a more current Western split between heart and mind that when we say heart, we point to our physical heart, and when we say mind, we point to our mind. But our mind is not in the brain, and our heart is not just located here. It's heart mind is the word chitta. It's consciousness, is the mysterious capacity to know, and then all of those beautiful qualities that flow from our consciousness, the unconfined capacity to both feel, respond, to be skillful, to everything flows from heart mind, from chitta. And this capacity to both become bound in our hearts and minds and to be liberated depends in many cases on our understanding. And what has occurred to me over the last many years is a little line. It's like a mantra that I use, that it is wise to be loving, and loving, the most loving thing you can do is be wise. And I was thinking that the emancipation of the heart begins with, or a central part of the emancipation of the heart, it comes with the wisdom to understand. And I'll use the line that my friend Wes Nisker uses, the wisdom that each of us, I'll just say you, as he says it, you are not your fault. That each of us is the heir, is the inheritor of beginningless causes and conditions. beginningless causes and conditions that are in a fundamental way not our fault, not personal. Everything that brought you into being happened outside of your control. You were born outside of your control. Everything that happened to your parents, your grandparents, your culture, everything about you, you could say, there's almost nothing that we can find within ourselves that exists completely independently from everything that brought us into being. And I find that very relieving. I don't know about you. And as soon as I expand my view, as soon as I widen my lens, I stop seeing myself as just this solid entity existing independently from life, a wave that's gotten separated from the ocean. Instead, I start recognizing that I am, in fact, neck deep in the current of causes and conditions, of cause and effect that has no beginning. I can start in the more recent present, where I was born into I often like to just acknowledge, I'm a 65-year-old white guy who was born into a Jewish family. And so being born into a Jewish family, in this culture, I have not always been the right kind of white guy, but I have been, through no fault of my own, born into these conditions. And because of being born into the conditions I've been in, I've been born into a certain kind of implicit privilege. Just because this is a culture that has been dominated by whiteness. Not my fault. And yet, by being aware of the conditions that brought me into being, and then to see that everyone is the heir of their conditions, I see that if you were born into another race, or you were born into a particular gender, you were born into a certain kind of gender identity or sexual identity or class or education, or most of it, right down to there's really nothing in any of us in how we were born that exists apart from everything that came before, from beginningless time. So no one can help themselves. It's no one's fault. Yet from our more narrow point of view, our narrow view of ourselves existing independently, and because of our narrow view that develops through the tendency of our mind to divide, to separate, to create a sense of that illusion of isolation, we have formed into groups, into views, we're all caught up in what the Buddha called the four floods, the flood of sexuality. So we are sensuality. Our mind is so preoccupied with seeking pleasurable experiences and arranging our lives around the satisfaction of desires that our view gets really narrow. And it becomes all about satisfying me, and so much identity is built around becoming. That's the second flood, the flood of becoming. I'm always on my way to the future. That makes my mind very narrow, and I forget that I'm sitting in a sea of connections. I'm part of a circle of being that's wider than wide and beginningless. The flood of sensuality, the flood of becoming, the flood of identity around our views. That gets hardened through the way that we divide and the way we separate. It gets hardened into opinions and views, and you can see the state of our body politic now around such polarization of views. These floods make us forget that we are not separate from each other, not separate from everything that ever brought us to be. It's like every single person here, no matter who you are, I couldn't be here if you weren't. Isn't that wild? I couldn't exist, I couldn't have this experience right now if you didn't have, unless somebody frowned or smiled at you some at the beginning of your life or 10 lifetimes ago. It's all part of a sea of interbeing. But from our when we're caught in the floods of sensuality and becoming and views and confusion about our ignorance, we just start thinking we're the one wave that's gotten separated from the ocean. And what that does is it creates that duality of self and other. And then once I exist as separate, then you are the other. And it all, and there's contentiousness. And yet that othering happens from the moment we're born. That's part of our conditioning too, of this creating a sense of individuality. Those who don't have a sense of individuality spend their whole lives trying to get it. But that individuality is easily forgotten as something that doesn't exist alone. We don't want to forget that. We want to keep our view really wide. Because the way it occurs over time is if you forget that, when you start to experience stress, and if you're born, as you know the basic teachings, if you're born, definition of birth, leading cause of stress, leading cause of frustration, leading cause of what's called dukkha, things that are hard to bear. Stress from being born, stress from getting ill, stress from aging, stress from dying, stress from work, stress from relationships, stress from sound, you know, the sound, everything. Just having senses. The Buddha called it sankhara dukkha. There's a constant impingement. We're constantly having to see, hear, smell, taste, and it's intense to be born. But when our view has gotten narrowed, we start thinking, it's just me. It's my fault that I'm stressed. And then what the movement of, because we're so individualistic, then everybody adopts things that are very individualistic to heal it. And one of those things, positive things, is meditation. I'm going to do that for myself. None but ourselves can free our minds. Of course, if you just saw it in a vacuum, your individuality in a vacuum, all the meditation in the world would make you divinely selfish. True meditation will lead you to the melting of you, the melting of this isolated, encased, fixed sense of individuality. It will melt your heart into the ocean of interbeing, of interdependence. But we are all trained, in this culture particularly, in hyper-individuality, in hyper disembodiment, hyper-rational thinking, hyper-self-judgment and self-blame. I don't know if I talked about it last week, but I talk about it a lot, just hearing about how the Dalai Lama was just so blown away by the amount of self-hatred and self-judgment. And One of my favorite teachers, Sri Nisargadatta, says self-judgment, self-hatred are grievous errors. They just completely miss the fact that we are affected by a sea of circumstances, and that to regard ourselves with hatred just takes blame where blame doesn't belong. It's because of the flood of confusion or ignorance that you blame yourself for the conditions of your own life. So I often tell a story, just to illustrate this, just that came out of my own practice period, and I see so many familiar faces, so forgive me for repeating this story. But I had a very heart-changing, mind-changing moment on a three-month meditation period that changed everything for me in terms of this tendency toward self-judgment. It started the unraveling of what had been a chronic sense of holding myself hostage, holding myself blame for my very existence. I would cut myself no slack, intense inner critic. And I was sitting this very long practice period, and I was sitting in my room all alone. And the room was about 7 or 8 feet wide by about 11 feet long. And I had my little foam mattress in the room, and there was no closet because the room was just so small, but there was a little dowel rack hanging from the side, and I put all my clothes there. And from the moment I got in that room, I kept saying to myself, you have so many clothes with you. You've got so much stuff. And I had lots of pillows. And I put nice paintings or pictures of tropical scenes on the wall to kind of warm my heart during the cold winter months at Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. And for 2 months out of that first 2.5 months, I would be in that room, and that room became very familiar. And I was certainly doing, I was hours, 18, 20 hours of practice every day. I got my sleeping down to 4 hours and 15 minutes. And if I slept 1 minute more, I would be dull. If I slept 1 minute less, I'd be dull. And I got into this whole little strange science of seeing how much sleep I actually needed, because I had taken to heart the Buddha's teaching that the biggest cause of dullness is too much food and too much sleep. Believe it or not, that sounds kind of different than our modern science. But anyway, I'm sitting in this room, and whenever I was a little uncomfortable, I'd look around and I'd see all my stuff. And half of the time, I would judge myself a little bit for having so much stuff. The other half of the time, I would plan having more stuff. I would think about wearing certain things and getting them in different colors, and then I would judge that too. You know, so that was part of my form of mental illness that would take place. But all of this, it was part of the field of mindfulness, so I was noticing it. And an interesting thing happened as I went along, and this I'll do this in about 3 minutes. I sat there, and as my mind got quieter and quieter and quieter, and the mindfulness got more and more continuous, the world that I would ordinarily see of objects began to break down. Everything began to deconstruct. And it was literally like I was seeing through the folds of the world, seeing how everything was arising and fading, and that there was really no there. You know, it was that's what happens when the power of mind is like putting mind and body under a microscope, and the world becomes completely deconstructed, and it liberates the mind from the confusion of seeing everything as dense and hard and separate as we ordinarily do. But parallel to this process of deconstructing reality was the feeling of being getting more and more, I call it psychologically regressed. I was getting younger and younger and younger, and I would look around at the stuff in the room and the experiences of sights and sounds and smells and tastes, and I would be absolutely overwhelmed by it, like I was a little baby just having my senses impinged upon and being just flooded. And there was a certain point where I felt so regressed and so young and everything impinging so intensely on my senses that I couldn't handle it. And I felt so young and so raw, and I realized, I realized I need to be held. I felt like a little infant. And I realized that there was no one there to hold me. Clearly, I'm sitting alone in a room, no one there to hold me. So what did I do? I rolled off of my cushion that was sitting on my foam pad, grabbed all the extra pillows that I had, wrapped them around my body, and I held myself. And with that moment of holding myself, I just started wailing. So young, so raw, needing to be held so much. And then in a flash of insight, I looked around at all the stuff in my room. And a thought went through my mind. Oh, that's how I've been trying to hold myself. By having a lot of stuff. And in that moment of recognition, it was as though my heart just went. It was like this piercing of my heart. And all of a sudden, this wave of self-compassion, of kindness, of love, flowed toward this mind and body. And I realized that I had been judging something that was in some ways, this the best I knew how, this intelligent way of trying to come to my own rescue. And that my flight from pain, or my seeking of pleasure and search for pleasure, was a kind of love. It was an attempt to love myself. And I had been busy judging it. And then I started to reflect on this particular methodology of trying to soothe myself. And I go, whoa, this is a consumer culture. This is how people try to hold themselves. Of course, it's completely misguided and ends up causing us more and more stress, but it's a sign of love. And so with more self-compassion toward myself, that never really ended after that. Even though the old threads of self-judgment would pop up, there was this almost default feeling of coming to my own rescue. At times where I didn't show up in some way, or somebody said something mean, or whatever it was that triggered some kind of pain, instead of judging myself or feeling vulnerable, this automatic reaction of kindness would come. But a more interesting response, for me anyway, was that then I started to see how everybody was doing the best they could with the causes and conditions that led them to be who they are. And everybody was, even all the misguided ways of even things that cause harm, are attempts to bring relief. And then it became the only wise response I could see to myself was to be loving. The only wise response to anyone else and their actions is to try to maintain that open-heartedness, even to those in this world, and it's a taller task, but even those who I consider perpetrators, that there's something in them that's attempting to find relief, and that, if I can connect with that, I can open my heart a little bit. Doesn't mean I like what they're doing, and doesn't mean that I don't devote my life to stopping what they're doing. But at least I don't have to hold them with the same ill will, the same sense of othering, the same sense of hatred that I did before. So I have to remind myself, of course, this is especially given our, never mind, the name that shall not be spoken, But it's wise to be loving. And the most loving thing you can do is wake up to your systemic non-separateness. That wisdom will open your heart, and if you open your heart, you will you'll be wise. That's so. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your generosity. And may we all be kind to ourselves this week, kind to others, and everybody should sign up for Mary's Brahma Vihara class, because that's what that's all about.